G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show anytime, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcasts. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Jayla Chet, who is doing a Master's in Translational Medicine under the supervision of Dr. Gord Boyd. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jayla. So before we actually talk about your research per se, just to let everyone know, I really first got to know you during the three-minute thesis competition. And I must say, if you want someone enthusiastic, it's Jayla, and always looking at ways to improve on anything that she's done, which is brilliant for someone who's going into research. So how did you find having to talk about your work in a different way than if, say, you're at a conference or amongst your peers? How did you find that?
In 3NT compared to academic conference? I think first thing is the audience is different. So really making your language more accessible to everybody. Things like scientific term like cerebral autoregulation. Right. And make it into oxygen level of the brain. Well, I vividly remember the title of my talk was Beyond Survival, Precision Resuscitation for ICU Survivor.
Yes.
And our moderator of the 3MT would always trip on the word resuscitation. So just making the language more accessible and also concise, because not everybody have the time. It's not like a posted presentation where they hang out with you for 10, 20 minutes. It's just 3 minutes and then after that, next candidate.
So why did you want to do translational medicine? Why that program out of all the programs you could have chosen?
Yeah, because I think it really aligned with my philosophy. I worked as a crisis line responder in my undergrad, where I identify these gaps in the system. I hear these stories that people are telling me, and it really motivated me to do something beyond that. And I was also highly involved with research in my undergrad. But there seems to be a disconnect. When I'm doing research, I don't get to really hear the patient's experience or see how they may be impacted by these research. And that led me to translational medicine, where the focus is patients. And,
right.
And you're working in a collaborative team with clinicians who take care of with patients themselves, to develop projects centered to their needs. So I'm very confident in the ability of my research to really make an impact in people's life. And at the end of the day, it's this philosophy that drew me to translational medicine.
Well, that's great, because it's I always find it interesting why people go into certain fields of study.
Yeah.
And you actually said that perfectly. I didn't realize you'd been on the crisis line and things like that, which, as you said, you probably hear an awful lot of what's going on. And a lot of the times it's misunderstandings that people have, or they don't know who to reach out to, or they've been shoved from one place to another and no one really knows.
Exactly. And it's given me so much inspiration, and I'm so, so privileged of all the stories I've heard and individuals willing to share their stories.
Which is not an easy thing for people to share or for you actually to listen to. It could be quite sad a lot of the times, I'm sure.
Exactly. And I think what's important is learning from these experiences and making sure they don't get lost in the system.
Yeah.
And making sure we have research there to empower people and improve the system.
Yeah, we have to make sure we don't just hear the voice, but we help channel that voice.
Exactly.
Whether it's channeling them to do it or you taking on that mantle for them.
Exactly. Very well said.
Oh, thank you. I feel like I'm on the other side of this. I love that. Okay. So the good news is 3 minute thesis that you did was 3 minutes. I'm going to give you 29. So I'm going to give you lots of time to help explain the kind of work that you're doing. So for everyone, you're probably waiting for me to tell you what she does. The research topic is personalizing blood pressure targets in the ICU to improve survivor cognitive outcomes. Now, I have a lot of questions there, even just from that topic, because we've got blood pressure. Are they at the right levels? We're in the ICU. looking at the patient and their cognitive outcomes. So there seems to be a lot going on there. So do you want to give us, first of all, just an overview of what you're studying and why? What was the initial problem? What made you get into this particular side of research?
Yeah, so the broad area of this research, we're looking at cognitive outcomes of patients. So we're looking at neuroscience.
Okay.
And this is something that I've always had an interest growing up. I always be fascinated about the brain and what are essential elements for a healthy and functional brain. And I think this interest was really consolidated in high school, where I volunteered for a long-term care home. And
okay.
I worked with a lot of seniors who experienced cognitive decline. And also my own grandparents are at the age where they experience memory problem, attention problems. And it turned this interest into advocacy.
Right.
Something that I want to do so I can empower people and making sure that they don't have to suffer and they have better quality of life. And in the end of my undergraduate study, I saw this research by my supervisor looking at cognitive impairment ICU survivor. It is not a population that I had a lot of experience with.
Right.
But after reading more about their lived experience, they're actually very highly impacted by cognitive impairment. Up to 40% of ICU survivors experience some sort of cognitive impairment after.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot. And 30% is equivalent to those who have mild Alzheimer. And
right.
These are people who had no problem before they got admitted to the ICU. And that can be very traumatic and very devastating impact on the quality of life, because you think, you know, you survived the ICU stay.
Yes.
And you're done, you know, back to normal. I need to go back to work to support my family. I need to, you know, go enjoy my retirement life by going traveling. But people are haunted by the cognitive impairment they endure after the ICU for years. And it just feels like your critical illness never left. You never fully recover. And that can be very devastating. And that's what essentially motivated me to continue to pursue this research and be there to find a solution to this problem.
So you're talking about people in the ICU, so they've had some sort of trauma. It could have been a car accident, a swimming accident, something that has made it critical for them to be into hospital.
Exactly. Like, vehicle accidents are a reason for why people get admitted to the ICU. Like, vehicle crash, trauma. Other big reasons are cardiac arrest.
Right, right.
A sudden heart attack. Or big surgeries, if you need to get a heart transplant.
Right.
To get a significant organ transplant.
So people are going in for instance, an organ transplant or a smashed up leg and things. How are those injuries, being in the ICU, affecting the brain or the cognitive functioning?
That's the exact question that we're trying to answer with our research. Is we couldn't puzzle for a long time why something that affects a different organ system would also have an effect on the brain. And a potential answer to that is oxygen level of the brain while patients are in a coma state. So when patients are in a coma state, there are not many ways to understand what exactly is going on in their brain.
Right.
When they're in a coma state, because we can't ask them questions like, are you doing okay?
Right.
And that's most cognitive assessments are behavioral. But there's technologies being developed. And the technology that we use for our research called near infrared spectroscopy is a type of oximeter that sends wavelengths and lights into your deep brain tissues.
Okay.
And seeing how much oxygen level there is in these tissue. And using that research, we found that patients with low cerebral oxygen level is associated with delirium and other outcomes.
Okay, so they're not getting enough oxygen to the brain.
They're not getting enough oxygen to the brain. And also the ability of the brain to make sure it does get enough oxygen is oftentimes impaired in these patients.
Right, and why would it be impaired in these patients at the time? That's what you're trying to figure out.
This is what we're trying to figure out with a study. We're in our ICU. We're taking different metrics. Like, we're taking their carbon dioxide value in their blood. We're taking their blood pressure. We're taking their demographic characteristics. And we're trying to look at all these factors and then doing statistical analysis to see what exactly is predicting dysfunction.
So when people in the ICU now, you often see people getting the oxygen mask. I know myself, and I've been in hospital, you get the oxygen mask and sometimes the little tubes up your nose to make sure that oxygen is flowing, et cetera, et cetera. How do they know what levels to do? And is this part of the problem? Because you talked about there's a lack of oxygen getting into the brain. So is it something else, or is it we're not feeding enough oxygen while they're in the ICU, when, for instance, they could be in a coma and things like that? They're hoping the body's going to do it for them. Whereas sometimes when we're alive, I know it's an automatic system to breathe and everything, but maybe in those states it's not the same. So it needs more help in regulating.
I think this really started with research a few decades before, where there were studies being done to identify this mechanism of the brain that makes sure it gets enough oxygen and blood flow to self-regulate. So the mechanism is called cerebral autoregulation for individuals who are interested.
This is the brain's unique protective mechanism to ensure that when there are fluctuations in blood pressure in the body, the brain remains undamaged. For example, when we're exercising, our bodily blood pressure peaks to deliver oxygen and nutrients to the muscles around the body. However, this doesn't affect the blood pressure in the brain because of cerebral autoregulation. Similarly, when we sleep, our blood pressure drops, yet the brain is still not deprived of oxygen or nutrients.
This mechanism is always believed to be very powerful. If your blood pressure is above 60, between 60 to like 100 or 120, it's believed that your brain is capable of adjusting this to the right pressure that it needs.
Right.
But what we recently found is that this mechanism is impaired in critically ill patients. And what enabled us to do that, again, is the advancements in technology. We had no way of like assessing oxygen levels in the patient's brain
right.
without actually doing surgical incision of a probe.
Right, which is a bit invasive
and
dangerous.
It's not acceptable for everybody.
Yes.
And so it's very fortunate now that we have non-invasive technology that allows us to identify this problem and now developing a solution to potentially adjust the level of blood pressure and adjust the level of oxygen in the brain to make sure it's optimized and it's at the right amount it needs.
Because I think, if I remember rightly from your 3EMT, up until this point, everyone virtually got the same amount.
Yes.
Which doesn't necessarily work for every person.
Yeah, so most of the medical guidelines recommend keeping individuals' blood pressure above 60 millimeter mercury or 65. And as long as their blood pressure don't fall below that threshold, it is deemed acceptable in the clinical setting. But some people, as we discussed before, may need a higher blood pressure because of hypertension or because of other physiology of the brain and the brain muscles. And it's very important that we have a way of capturing that and making sure that they receive the right blood pressure treatments that they need.
So these little nodes that you put on people, how easy is that? Because one of the things about in an ICU or in a hospital setting in general is that, first of all, if we've got new technologies which can help us, how accessible is it for hospitals to get? How easy is it to use? What kind of training needs to be given? I mean, these all come down to the costs of new technology, which hopefully will be more efficient. But if a hospital can't afford it, then we're going to have some hospitals that have better treatment than others. And really, we should be trying to make sure everyone has equal access to great care.
That's an amazing question. And the story of this research on the brain's capacity to self-regulate in the ICU started with a technology where it's basically a probe where someone needs to hold and have it on the forehead of the individual while they're recording.
Okay.
While they're recording.
So one person is doing that.
One person is doing that, and the person needs to be trained on it. And it was a good assessment of blood flow, but later onwards, there's a lot of question about its feasibility because one person needs to be holding the probe or adjusting the probe to make sure that it's not gliding off the head, making sure that it's detecting signal all the time. And that is often not feasible and it's very like resource intensive. Mm-hmm. So subsequently, companies developed this tag that detects the oxygen level in the patient's brain, that which we use in our research, where you can just stick on people's forehead, make sure it's secure with a tape that they use in the ICU. And that's it. You just leave it on for 24 hours and you get rarely any missing signals.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's critical in the ICU for a lot of things. They say, well, see how a patient's going to be in the next 24 hours. Is that waiting too long to help figure out the oxygen levels that this this particular person should be getting?
That's a very good question. I think it could be, it totally could be. Early critical illness is so essential to their subsequent health in the ICU. And I think we're fortunate to know that in the research that look at this functional autoregulation, they're looking at the first 72 hours. So if it takes you 24 hours to identify this blood pressure target, there's still 48 hours where you can do something.
To rectify.
To rectify or do something to improve and see if it does make a difference.
Okay.
And also the algorithm that we use right now do need several hours of recording in order to calculate the blood pressure.
Right, which makes sense.
How they interact. But I do think in the ideal world, and there's some research that's developing prototypes for that, it's real-time feedback.
Yes.
So you always record the blood pressure and other and oxygen level, and you adjust the target as times go. But those prototypes don't exist yet.
Right. But they could.
They could.
At least you're all thinking about it, knowing that we need to have a quicker result.
Exactly.
And it's still better than what you're doing now is still better than what it was before.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
Everyone was treated the same.
Exactly. And we're trying to research and see if different, I guess, time benchmarks are useful or not. We're recording for 24 hours and then we're targeting for 40 hours. Mm-hmm. Maybe this can be adjusted to 12 hours.
Right.
And then 12 hours of treatment and re-recording for 12 hours and then 12 hour treatment. So there's different paradigms that can be tested.
When people in the ICU, some of them, you know, they're going to be there because they've come in for electives. Well, it's not always elective surgery, but, you know, heart transplants and things. They know they're going in for that. Mm-hmm. Whereas a car accident, you never know when that's going to happen. So they just turn up. For those people who, you know, who are coming in, say, for elective surgery, the heart transplants and things, where you've got time beforehand, can you measure their blood pressure and things beforehand to give you an idea of what it should be post-surgery? Or is it really something that you really have to do post-surgery?
From what I've read, I think this has to be something that you do post-surgery when they're in the ICU.
Because your body's in more stress.
Exactly. And you're receiving different medications from when you're doing the surgery or before the surgery. That could affect your cerebral autoregulation. And we just don't know. So I do think it has to be after the surgical procedure when individuals are in the ICU to do this recording and calculate their blood pressure. And I think that has been studied done before, correlating their optimal blood pressure post-surgery with during the surgery and even with their regular blood pressure before they enter the surgical OR. And they found that's not a predicting factor.
So it's not a predicting. Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? You want to try and predict what it needs to be at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
So with all of that, because you've mentioned a lot of different things there, you know, looking at how blood pressure, a little bit about blood flow, but more about blood pressure, how it's getting to the brain, and then how you're trying to monitor it to make sure that you figure out the right levels that should be getting to the brain to reduce the risk of cognitive dysfunction. And then you've talked about calculations and things, and then this little gizmo that can help track all of this. What's the main part that you're working on? Because this is big picture. What's the main part that you're working on right now?
Yeah, thank you for this question. And it does get a little confusing because we have so many research.
Yes, because lots of people are doing different things. Yes,
exactly. And what the specific part I am looking at is whether we can rapidly identify people's blood pressure, optimal blood pressure, using the 24 hours, 48 hours paradigm. So recording for 24 hours, identify blood pressure, and maintaining them in their blood pressure range for the next 48 hours, and seeing what other challenges there are to this treatment protocol, and gathering some information on the preliminary clinical outcomes.
And then post that, once you can gather this kind of information, what are you hoping to happen in the ICU moving forward?
I think it depends on what type of feasibility results we get.
Right.
We're trying to see if we can identify their optimal blood pressure in real time.
Yep.
And trying to maintain it with the medication that we already have in the ICU, norepinephrine and labetalol. So they're two type of blood pressure controlling medications.
Okay.
And we're trying to also see sort of the underlying question is, are these medications sufficient? Do we have enough human resources to make sure everybody's treatment is personalized, and any other barriers? Does the software function consistently? And if we're able to get the success rate that we've deemed acceptable, we'll move on with doing a larger randomized control study.
Are you getting results right now?
We're getting results right now.
That are showing that we can monitor okay and determine levels?
Yeah, so right now
I know it's only small, but yes.
Yeah, right now we're halfway through the study and we found that it's not an issue to identify people's optimal blood pressure.
Well, that's good.
The challenge comes with actually maintaining people in the individual range.
Right.
For some people, their range is very small.
Right, okay.
7-9 millimeter mercury. And it can be really hard for our nurses who are very understaffed in the ICU to constantly keep an eye on the individuals and maintain them in that range.
Right, right. So one, it's identifying it, and two, it's continually making sure they are in that range.
Yeah.
Which probably would fall on the nurse or something, correct?
Exactly, right. Which will fall on our hardworking nurses.
Yes.
Who's taking care of multiple patients. And that's very important information to capture mm-hmm. in the ICU, whether it's feasible or not. Currently, we're looking at if patients can be maintained with their range above 90% of the time.
Right.
When we're monitoring, that may not be feasible. But that's the question to ask. If it's 50%, 60%, mm-hmm. if it's 30% increase from their baseline from the first 24 hours of recording, is that still acceptable? I think these are the questions.
So what is acceptable? And then would someone in this study, not necessarily you, would somebody then, once you move further along in this, think about follow-up with these patients? Because it's one thing of trying to do the right thing while they're in hospital. But what happens when they go home? They may be functioning perfectly well while they're in hospital, but then they go home and get on with their normal life, and who knows, something else could have happened.
We do follow up with patients 3 months and 12 months after the discharge to see how they're recovering back home.
That's good.
And it is a hope that this intervention will be able to improve their cognitive outcome when they're back home.
So when you follow up, can you still go and take some oxygen levels of the brain just to see if it's still maintaining in with acceptable range?
We don't do that because the evidence is showing the cerebral autoregulation oxygen level early critical illness is associated with long-term cognitive outcome.
Okay, right.
So first few days in ICU is mm-hmm. really critical for these neurological recovery.
It's an important one that you're doing, really important, because I imagine once you get more and better results and better ways of doing this, it's one more thing that, though, if any of us happen to be in an ICU or have a loved one in an ICU, for instance, we know there's one extra step that's being done now to have that person come out and still possibly live a good life.
Exactly. And, you know, this is statistics from the research done in 2014. We know that 230,000 Canadians go to the ICU each year.
Oh, wow.
And at that time, they found that there was an increasing trend. It's a 12% increase from 2007, so from 4 years ago.
Right.
So I have no doubt that, you know, with the COVID pandemic and population growth, this number is increasingly higher.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine, let's say, the mortality rate in the ICU is about 20%. So 80% of patients do surviving their ICU stay. And half of them, so about 40%, or 30%, have these cognitive impairment. That's a lot of Canadians.
That is a lot of Canadians.
It's a lot of Canadians every year that there needs to be something to make sure that they return home and they recover well and doesn't have to have their life interrupted
mm-hmm.
from this sort of negative consequence of critical illness.
One more question, which I didn't ask earlier. Are you finding right now, and I know everyone is an individual, but does age have a factor in people? So those in ICU who are later in years are finding it harder to regulate as opposed to younger ones, or has it made no difference whatsoever? Is it a function of age, or is it a function of what's happening in the ICU?
I think it can be so many things that makes age less predicting of a factor.
Okay.
If that makes sense. There has been research before that looked at whether demographic characteristics, things like age, gender, your reason of being admitted to the ICU, and your other comorbidities you may have is predicting of your optimal blood pressure range.
Right.
And they found that none of the individual factor is predicting, because there's so many different factors that interact with each other. So that's sort of where the research is at right now. And individuals who are older are more likely to have worse cognitive outcome after they're discharged from the ICU. But
because they always say,
mm-hmm,
having an operation later in life, mm-hmm, there's a lot more complications,
yeah,
potential complications.
The other thing to account for, I guess, is frailty. Our hospital, the Kingston General Hospital, does a lot of research about frailty and how that impacts outcome. And it is a significant predictor. And as you get older, you become less mobilized, and mm-hmm, your overall, you're just more fair on body function. And that also predicts how you recover afterwards. But that's sort of a different topic.
Different topic. So in terms of your research, you're doing some fabulous work, and clearly there's a lot more that needs to be done, like a bigger study, etc. But it looks like you're all going on the right direction. Anything that can help in the ICU, and as you mentioned, make the quality of life post-ICU to be a good one.
Exactly.
It's got to be quite heartwarming for everyone who may end up there at some stage.
Exactly. And I think it affects, like you said, it's, critical illness can affect everyone. Not saying that it should.
Yeah,
Not saying that it should.
But it can.
But, you know, I've known someone in my life, not my immediate family members, but, you know, my friend's grandparents who had to have surgery and ended up in the ICU. And, you know, I do think it's important that we see that as sort of the standard of care, that mm-hmm, it's not just care in the ICU. And I think it's widely recognized now. It's not just about we making sure they survive their critical illness and that's it. We're doing everything we can to make sure that they not only survive, but they continue return home to their families, return to work, to support their living,
mm-hmm,
and return to their enjoyable activities so they don't experience mental distress or mm-hmm, feeling of isolation or feeling like lack of independence. They're all very, very important. Because then we're moving to an existential question about, you know, what does living well really mean?
Yeah.
And I think to a lot of people, this means not just being able to breathe and being really enjoying what's happening and having that health to be able to embrace and fully take in everything that's happening around you.
Yeah.
And when I reflect,
and being in control of it.
Being in control of it. And I was doing research about this. I also listened to a lot of patient stories as well. And there was one really stick with me. It was sort of a younger individual who, he wasn't an ICU survivor, but he had a moderate traumatic brain injury.
Right.
And what I think was really upsetting and heartbreaking for me is, you know, he realizes that there's something wrong about the way his brain is working.
Right.
He realizes that there's something changing about the way he's seeing, his reasoning. He feels like there's something missing about himself. And also his loved ones seeing that. He's becoming less and less like who he was before.
He was before. And it must be hard knowing you're going through that.
Exactly. And it's hard for everybody mm-hmm. to feel like their body is uncontrollably changing and declining. And especially, I think the brain is, you know, it's a crucial part of our identity and who
yeah.
we are.
Yeah.
And that's why I think cognitive impairment and cognitive decline is such an important issue
mm-hmm.
To making sure that everyone, whether it is aged gracefully or feels protected from for any accidental thing that can happen in their
right.
life and that leads mm-hmm. them to critical illness.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. I mean, I know I could keep going and going because there's so much I could keep asking you, you know, can this be translated into other areas, da 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 da. But we don't have time for that, unfortunately. So, Jayla, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. And thank you for enlightening us about possible ways to make, if you have to go to the ICU, a lot better for you in the long term. So thank you very much for showcasing that for us.
For sure. My pleasure. Thank
Very
you.
Good. Okay, so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcasts. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.